Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent dilemma Russia's President Putin faces when he seems to be trapped between continuing his support to support his proxies in eastern Ukraine, who he can't sell out, along with his new Russia project with all of its propaganda momentum that he can hardly reverse, and protecting his markets in Europe and the fortunes of the oligarchs who are presumably giving him an earful as their billions dwindle. Catherine Stoner, a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies and deputy director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, joins us to discuss the internal pressures on Putin and whether, since Russia has leverage over European countries as the main supplier of gas, do Russia's customers in Europe have leverage over Russia as well? Then we will speak with Jennifer Saron Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin. She spent time living in Palestinian refugee camps and worked for 5 months in the Gaza Strip at the Mezen Center for Human Rights in Gaza City, and joins us to discuss whether the growing outrage around the world as the mounting civilian deaths, as the civilian deaths mount in Gaza, whether that will alter the pro-Israel stance taken by America's politicians and president and press, and whether, as the decades-long Palestinian issue remains unsettled, in the long term, public opinion will shift against Israel, as it has done in Europe. Then finally, we will speak with an airline pilot who has flown the air corridor over Ukraine, where the Malaysian airliner was shot down, to get a sense of what kind of notification airlines get from intelligence services about the dangers from war zones, where capabilities on the ground can change rapidly, as they have done recently in Ukraine and Iraq, countries civilian airliners routinely fly over. Patrick Smith, an active airline pilot and author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections, joins us to discuss the growing number of airliners shot down by missiles and his article at the Huffington Post, Malaysia Airlines Crash May Become Seventh Deadliest Disaster in Aviation History. And joining us now is Catherine Stoner, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies and deputy director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, The Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stoner.
Thank you.
And the developments today pretty much that the President Obama, as you know, has been sort of ratcheting up the rhetoric. He's very careful not to come out of the gate with full blame. But as the days mount and as the outrage around the world mounts, particularly from the Malaysian Prime Minister and the Dutch Prime Minister vis-a-vis the desecration and outrageous disrespect for the bodies of the victims, he's gotten more closer to blaming Putin. What's your sense, though, of the dilemma that Putin is in, where, on the one hand, I can't see him backing away from supporting his proxies and selling them out, nor can I see him backing away from the enormous momentum of the propaganda machine that he's unleashed along with his new Russia project?
Mm-hmm. So, I think sometimes we outside world, that is outside of Russia, think that he cares more about international public opinion than he really does. He cares a lot about his internal public opinion, and regularly is polling, even though he is he's managing a very repressive state. So he tends to fear his own street, and so this is partly why it's largely why the news broadcasts within Russia themselves are putting forward theories like maybe it was a missile fired by the Ukrainian military in a failed assassination attempt, because Putin's plane was actually in that vicinity around the same time he was on his way back from Brazil. It's really presenting the story in a completely different way than what we're seeing here. And it's since about 85-90% of people get their news through television, and television is for the most part state-run and regulated. It's pretty hard to fight that message within Russia.
But in terms of a dilemma, you know, it would seem that he can't reverse the message. And as you've just pointed out, he doesn't necessarily want to because that's his main audience. But mm-hmm. he does have a foreign audience in as much as that's where so much of the trade is, particularly in Europe with gas. Already the Dutch are apparently extremely upset. Now, they have a trade imbalance with Russia that's quite profound. But they do have an LNG terminal that is not being used particularly. And it seems to me that there is a reverse leverage that the European customers of Russian gas have. We keep talking about Russia's leverage over them as a supplier, but isn't there a potential leverage that the customers could have?
Sure. There's, you know, Russia's economy is also dependent on selling. So, oil and gas are pretty much their only big exports. And so their economy and their GDP moves in lockstep with the price of oil in particular. The big dependency is really Germany. And this is, Germany gets about 30% of its natural gas. France gets nothing. England gets nothing from Russia. So it's really Germany and then the Baltic republics, they get up 100%. It's pretty significant, up over 60-70% for other East European countries like Poland and Hungary, et cetera.
And Italy, by the way. Italy is fairly dependent as well.
Yes, Italy is too, right, but not a huge economy Germany's. Germany also sells a lot of things to Russia, and so that's another reason for the hesitancy in terms of going too far with sanctions, because you know what? Angela Merkel doesn't want to hurt the German economy any more than she has to as well. But Russia needs the things that they're selling. So, you know, I think sometimes this dependency story, as you're correctly pointing out, is overplayed. It's not just the Germans or the Dutch who are dependent on the Russian natural gas. It's the Russians are dependent as well, especially on the Germans, but also for investment. And, you can only see investment going down in Russia at a time when the economy is already dipping very close to recession this last quarter.
So that adage by the dissident chess master, Garry Kasparov, that mm-hmm. Putin is more afraid of banks than tanks, do you think that holds?
I think it rhymes nicely, and I admire Garry. I think he has a lot of really interesting things to say about Russia and unique insights. That is, you know, not completely inaccurate. But banks are not the only thing he's fearful of. But certainly he's fearful of the effect it will have on his economy. I think right now the policy discussion in Moscow is between business people and the billionaires who care most about what's happening to banks. And on July 16th, the United States, the day before the plane went down, we announced our toughest sanctions yet, and these are sanctions against Gazprom Bank and Vnešekonom Bank, which is those are two of the largest banks that facilitate first oil and gas trade and also international development trade. So they're not going to be able to clear long-term debt through U.S. financial markets. We did the same thing with Rosneft in this round of sanctions. So those are pretty significant. They're gonna have a significant hit on the Russian economy. And so the debate is really between the billionaires who are concerned about that and the folks within the security apparatus close to Putin who are saying full steam ahead, this is our moment. I think the sort of confused or mixed response, or muted perhaps is a better way of putting it, from Putin so far internationally, it reflects this. And the fact that this video came out at 1:40 a.m. saying that Russia wants to see a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Ukraine and will do everything it can to support that. I think that reflects coming out of a meeting late at night and realizing we've got to do something here. But the response seems, at this point, muted and slightly mixed or confused.
Well, of course, Russia did eventually vote with the Australian-sponsored UN resolution. Mm-hmm. Presumably, they simply couldn't veto it. It would have been too embarrassing. They did try to water the language down. Instead of it that originally said the shoot down of the plane, it now says the downing of the plane. Mm-hmm. But the Siloviki that you referred to, the former intelligence people mm-hmm. surrounding Putin, many of them are, of course, many have argued that Putin, in fact, regulates the oligarchs, perhaps even takes a cut. Bloomberg is reporting that three or four of the biggest ones are losing money quite rapidly yeah. compared to American oligarchs who are getting richer by the day. So what's your sense then of how much he listens to them? And I think there is a bit of a confluence, is there not, between the Siloviki and the oligarchs?
Yeah, sure. They're not perfectly separated groups, and certainly, one of the many, many fascinating things about Russian economics and politics is the tremendous overlap between business and government. So, that said, there are definitely some within the Siloviki, the security group, that are far more hawkish and much more confident of the world's need for Russia's oil and gas than the so-called billionaires who have a perhaps more sophisticated understanding of how Russia is now tied into the international global economy. So I think that's really where the conflict is.
So do you think Usmanov, who apparently has lost like $2 or $3 billion of late, is weighing in?
Sure. I think there are a lot of phone calls and meetings going on in and around the Kremlin right now about this. And, these sanctions haven't really taken deep effect yet either, this latest round, right? This just was passed 4 or 5 days ago or introduced 4 or 5 days ago. So this puts a lot of the deals Rosneft, in particular Russia's largest oil exporter, which is led and directed right now by a close colleague of Putin's, Igor Sechin, who also comes out of this St. Petersburg group of former security guys. This is going to hit them quite hard. It may imperil some of their deals with Exxon to explore the Arctic and to help Rosneft get going on fracking. Russia's been slower on that. So, this is $2 or $3 billion is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what the total economy, of course, could lose. So there's some real debate going on right now, I'm sure.
Well, that's essentially my question here is the dilemma, and where on the one hand Putin has got to consider these factors that we've just been talking about. On the other hand, he's riding the tiger, I think, of his own yep. rhetoric and the extent to which he's what, at 83% in the polls now. The Russian people have an entirely, they're in a different universe of right. information. The media is blaming the Ukrainians for everything, including yep. the shoot down of the plane, and they're also blaming them for the lack of access to the site, the desecration of the bodies, everything that the pro-Russian proxies are doing. So, right. and as I mentioned earlier, I don't see him reversing that. Do you?
No, I don't think so. But, one of the unfortunately clever things that's happened here is that he hasn't given a full bear hug embrace to the proxies, as you call them, to these rebels. So, it's not beyond him to say, look, these guys have nothing to do with us. We're not endorsing anything that they've done. That's still a possibility. He has that out there. He doesn't want to own Ukraine. I'm quite confident of that. But he wants to keep it destabilized and unattractive to the European Union. Therefore, and within Russia's sphere of influence, that's his sort of longer term plan is to reestablish Russia as the great power it once was and what he feels it still is. This is his sort of imperial dream, if you will. It's not to resurrect the Soviet Union, but it's to resurrect Russia as an important, crucial actor in international politics and unrivaled regional hegemon in that part of the world.
But Catherine Stoner, apparently the Ukrainian military are back on the offensive. And I spoke yesterday to Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, who's a fairly highly regarded defense analyst who seems to have good connections. His scenario about what's happening on the ground made an awful lot of sense. He was saying that these pro-Russian rebels are pretty much getting routed by the Ukrainian army that's more or less starting to get its act together.
Right, right.
And that what the Ukrainian army have done is that they've sent in pockets of troops on the Russian border to interdict the flow of arms and material coming across, and that some of these groups of Ukrainian soldiers had been cut off, and the only way to supply them was by airdrop, and that's what mm-hmm. these transport planes were doing. And then, on the other hand, carefully calibrating it from the Russian side, as Putin appears to be, they decided to introduce ground-to-air missiles in order to take away the Ukrainian Air Force's ability to airdrop supplies to these troops, and thus this led to this shootdown. Obviously, they weren't intending to shoot down an airliner. So that seems to make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah,
What's your reaction to that?
No, that probably is as good a story as any, right? And
right.
If you knew that troops or supplies were being moved in any of these airplanes, then it would be perfectly reasonable to try to shoot them down. But yeah, I'm very confident it was an accident. They didn't mean to hit a civilian airliner, and you can tell. I mean, this is one of the reasons I think that they've been very, very hesitant. The rebels separatists, depending on your perspective, they've been very hesitant to allow in investigators, because what will such an investigation show? It will show that the plane was downed by a missile. It will show where the missile came from. And then there, you follow that string, and there will be criminal indictments, presumably, against some of them. So not being particularly sophisticated guys on the ground, and not understanding the reach of international media, they think this was the best strategy for them to try and, hide some of the evidence and not allow access to the site in a timely manner. They obviously did not realize the blowback that would occur from this. And, now if the black boxes are in fact handed over to the Prime Minister of Malaysia, then, we'll gradually, I would bet, get confirmation that, in fact, it was hit by a missile, and here's probably where it came from, and here's, they may find evidence in the wreckage of, who knows, a serial number or whatever that can be traced, and someone's going to be held responsible. So I think that's what that was all about.
But the president's remarks on Monday came pretty close to laying it pretty much in Putin's lap.
Yeah.
If presumably these black boxes aren't tampered with and that the evidence comes out as you just suggested, how much then in terms of the conspiracy laws, which do hold those responsible, not those who executed the crime, but those who, the intellectual authors of the crime, could that make its way to Putin?
I don't know enough about international law, honestly, to say that. I think it would probably be hard to make all of those logical leaps unless you can find some kind of smoking gun, email or recording or something like that, where he's saying, let's give them these books, let's, do this or that. And I don't think that Russian communications companies are likely to turn anything like that over. So I think it would be hard, but, the suspicion is enough. And I think his reception in the international community is quite different this week than it was even a week ago or a week and a half ago.
But given that Putin is somewhat the czar and has pretty much total control, and he's a former intelligence officer who apparently likes to micromanage these things, do you think that he, in fact, who would have authorized sending the Buk missile across to equal the playing field, assuming that scenario is correct?
Well, so, he doesn't have total control. I think that Russian politics are a lot more complicated than that. But he likes to micromanage some things. That's for sure. I think it's very difficult to say whether he is personally giving orders, but he certainly is giving orders to Sergei Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, who is a very, very, loyal agent of Putin's. And it would be very difficult to comprehend Shoigu not knowing that these missile systems were going across the border. But again, it was an accident.
Right.
But this is what happens when you allow people to have these missiles, and clearly they were not thinking of the possibility of a commercial airliner being there at that time. They were sure. We know from the social media messages that have now been removed by the rebels, they were sure that it was a transport plane.
Right, but my understanding is that this equipment crossing the border was, in fact, the straw that broke the camel's back with the U.S. The intelligence people informed the White House that this was happening, and that's when they pulled the trigger on these new round of sanctions.
Yes, that's right, and that's what produced the sanctions July 16th. But, you know, there's been a lot of activity on the border, and they've put troops back, and we've known that, and so that's why we brought these sanctions out. I think what's happened, unfortunately, is that with the killing of so many civilians who had absolutely nothing to do with this conflict, the world's attention has really been focused on whether this is some sort of international crime. And, you know, it's heinous. It's an awful thing that happened. But these things, unfortunately, have happened before and happened to the Soviet Union. They shot down a Korean airliner accidentally, and Ukraine itself did shoot down an airliner going from Tel Aviv, I think, into Siberia about 10 or 12 years ago. So these things happen. The question is, how enduring is the impact? And, you know, you asked if there is a scenario where you could tie it right back to a command from Putin. I don't think you'll find that evidence. I just don't think the Russians would ever supply it.
Well, Catherine Stoner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stoner, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the latest Israeli actions in Gaza. Like it, say it again.
وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقط حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك انسرقنا من ارضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالنا انقلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي اسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين ما كان بسولي كل هاد لمين وين 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 الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer Saren Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin and is the program director at the university's A.E. Haven Center for the Study of Social Structure and Social Change. She lived in Israel in her childhood. Her father played in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, and she studied there in college. And she also spent time living in Palestinian refugees camps and worked for 5 months in the Gaza Strip at the Mazan Center for Human Rights in Gaza City. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Saren Lowenstein.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And today the fighting continued in the Gaza Strip. The casualties on the Palestinian side are about 511 at this point, but they're mounting all the time. Israel suffered 7 more soldiers dead, bringing their military death toll to 25. What's your sense of whether or not this meeting that's taking place as we speak in Cairo late at night between the Secretary of State John Kerry and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and presumably General Sisi, is there any likelihood that that those three players could affect things on the ground, which are largely presumably between Israel and Palestine?
I think the likelihood of anything coming out of it is entirely dependent on the United States and Israel. I think the demands that the Hamas government are making on Israel are completely justifiable demands. That does not mean that I endorse Hamas as an organization. Many people assume that when a person criticizes Israel or defends the people of Gaza, that one is automatically supporting Hamas. That's simply not true. The Gaza Strip has been existing under unbelievably difficult conditions for well over 7 years, or since Hamas began its rule in Gaza. Hania, the president or the leader of Hamas, is basically demanding that any ceasefire mean the lifting of the seven-year-old siege on the Gaza Strip. That is a completely understandable and, in my view, necessary demand. The people of Gaza cannot go on living under siege without even humanitarian aid getting into the Strip on a regular basis.
But isn't it also reasonable for the Israelis to insist that Hamas fire no more missiles at Israel?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I said, isn't it therefore reasonable that there should be a quid pro quo and that the Israelis are justified in insisting that no more Hamas missiles rain down on Israel?
Personally, I would prefer to see everybody sitting down at negotiating tables and nobody attacking anyone militarily. Aggression on the part of Israel, the country that started this latest round of violence, is considered the supreme war crime by justices who presided at the Nuremberg trials. So first of all, I want to state that I don't think violence is going to settle this conflict. At the same time, I don't think the people of Gaza should be lying down while Israel attacks them. Israel has the fourth most powerful military in the world, and the Gazans have quite primitive rockets, and they are basically shooting these rockets to keep the Israeli people psychologically in a state of fear. That's about it. They're not very effective. I think two civilians have died in Israel, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think that most people don't understand, however, that the Israelis are basically attacking the population of Gaza indiscriminately, and that there are close to 600 people dead now. In the latest discussion I had with a person on the ground in Gaza, the death toll is nearing 600, with the overwhelming majority of people being civilians. That is almost inconceivable for people who have been following these developments. I try to ask people how they would feel if the tables were turned, if Israel were occupied by a foreign nation with an incredibly powerful military and that they were being killed en masse by a country occupying them. Would they just sit there and lie down and not do anything? I'm sure they would do everything they could to resist.
And, of course, the United Nations, their preliminary view of casualties in Gaza found that more than 72% of those killed were civilians, not militants, and that includes a large number of women and children. Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Saren Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin and is the program director at the university's A.E. Haven Center for the Study of Social Structure and Social Change. She lived in Israel in her childhood. Her father played in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, and she studied there in college and spent a lot of time in the Palestinian refugee camps and worked for 5 months in the Gaza Strip at the Mezan Center for Human Rights in Gaza City. So I spoke yesterday to a former British intelligence officer with MI6, who was also the foreign policy advisor to the head of the EU, and spent a lot of time brokering ceasefires in the Middle East.
Yes.
And he was saying that the Hamas has, there's a military strategy in what Hamas is doing, and that they borrowed it from Hezbollah in their war with Israel, that the shooting of these missiles from tunnels is designed to draw in Israeli boots on the ground. As long as the Israel air superiority operates, they don't have a prayer. But if they can draw the boots on the ground in, because the only way to destroy these tunnels is to actually get in there on the ground. And once you're in on the ground in Gaza, I'm sure, as you know, having worked there, these streets are extremely narrow and easy to booby trap. And apparently, according to an Israeli officer in the midst of this battle, he said that, you know, you have to admit that these fighters on the other side are pretty effective, and they're firing from rooftops, windows, alleyways, all over the place. So,
well, they know the place. They know the area very well, and the Israelis do not, despite all of the military intelligence that they have. Trying to find one's way around the refugee camps and the streets of Gaza is extremely difficult. So it is highly possible that Hamas is borrowing certain tactics from Hezbollah. I don't think this is a recent development by any means. I think it goes back years to when Israel expelled somewhere between 300 and 400 Hamas members to southern Lebanon. I think the contacts between Hamas and Hezbollah began at least as far back as that, and in the early 90s. It makes sense that they would be talking to each other about these effective strategies because of the disproportionate strength of their militaries. One problem, however, is that the people who are living in Gaza have no place to go. Israel has an Iron Dome missile defense system. It has bomb shelters and underground places for people to run to and protect themselves. The people of Gaza have nothing of the sort, and they have no place to go when the bombing starts. Whenever I hear that Hamas militants are deliberately firing from populated areas, it sounds utterly absurd to me. You can't find an area of the Gaza Strip that isn't heavily populated. It's the most densely populated strip of land in the world. To imagine that one can strike at Hamas militants without killing dozens of civilians is preposterous. But I don't believe that's what's happening in any case. I think the Israelis are deliberately going in and killing as many Palestinians as they possibly can. I think that they do not care whether these people are women or children or civilians. I think that even in caste led, the commander, the Israeli commander of the south in Gaza, basically told his soldiers that the objective was to kill as many people as possible. That's what's happening. Gideon Levy, an Israeli journalist, recently wrote for Haaretz that the real reason for Israel going into Gaza was to kill Arabs, quote unquote. I think he really boiled it down to the most basic elements. Israel is ethnically cleansing the Gaza Strip. It is also it's doing the same in the West Bank, albeit with different tactics. The people in Gaza, as I mentioned before, have no place to go. Egypt does not want 1.7 million people pouring over its borders. It has enough poverty and enough problems of its own. Besides that, it's not Egypt that owes the people of Gaza help. Most of the people in Gaza, more than three-quarters of the people living there, are refugees whose homes are in these cities in Israel now that are being hit or targeted by rockets. In other words, the Palestinian people in Gaza who are resisting their occupation are people who used to live in the very towns and cities that they're firing at. They have the right to resist this occupation. We have to understand that. Unfortunately, in the rules of war, it is legal to kill other military personnel. 25 Israeli soldiers have died so far. I wish that there were no deaths on either side, but at least they are hitting military targets within Gaza. The reverse is not true, and I will say it again, my belief and the belief of many people watching this these developments unfold is that Israel is in there to kill people indiscriminately, disproportionately civilians, and that this is part of an overall strategy of creating fear, misery, and death. It is a policy of ethnic cleansing, and one that I see no stop to. I don't see any real hope for a full stop in the near future.
Well, Jennifer Sarn-Lowenstein, just in the last couple of minutes then, the Israelis can't kill all 1.7 or 1.8 million Gazans.
No.
And furthermore, as they kill, up to 600, as you say, the world is outraged. So the real question to me then becomes, what happens here as outrage around the world grows about these?
Well, exactly. I've written about this.
Right.
This is something, first of all, I want to make as much as I possibly can, and people who are working on this issue can. It's very important that we understand that 93% of the population of the world is on the side of the Palestinians. It is the United States and, to some extent, the United Kingdom who are supporting the Israelis. That's important for us to recognize. Anti-American sentiment is not just building up among Palestinians or among Iraqis or among Afghans. Anti-American sentiment and resentment has been growing and is reaching a boiling point, not for the first time. We saw 9/11. I don't know what it will take, and it scares me to even talk about this, to make Americans understand that our foreign policy is unacceptable. We do not have the right to go into any country we like at will and insist that the government and the people hand over their resources, do as we say, give them the control of assets over borders. We have military bases that entirely ring, encircle the state of Iran. The people, I'm not talking about the governments, the people of these countries are increasingly enraged by this. And how can anybody blame them? What would the American people feel if the Canadians or if the Afghans or any other people surrounded the United States with military bases, even in the sea, with gunboats? We're not talking about just a wall or a barrier, which is bad enough in the West Bank. We're talking in Gaza about an area of land that is shut off from the world, controlled by land, sea, and air, cyberspace, in every conceivable way by Israel.
Well, Jennifer Sarn-Lowenstein, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on, and let's just hope something happens and that there's some kind of breakthrough.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Saren Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin, and she's the program director at the University Center for the Study of Social Structure and Social Change. She lived in Israel in her childhood, and her father played in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, and she studied there in college and spent time living in Palestine in refugee camps and worked for 5 months in the Gaza Strip at the Mazen Center for Human Rights in Gaza City. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with an airline pilot who has flown over the air corridor over Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Patrick Smith, an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, Malaysia Airlines Crash May Become Seventh Deadliest Disaster in Aviation History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Smith.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Patrick, you've flown over this very same area in Ukraine. Why do you think it was that the FAA had told U.S. airlines not to fly over this area, and the Ukrainians had issued a directive saying that you should fly above 32,000 feet because a Ukrainian transport plane had been shot down earlier in this same area? And the plane itself, the Malaysian plane, was only flying 1,000 feet above that ceiling at 33,000 feet. Other airliners were using this corridor as well. So I guess that's my first question is why, if the Americans weren't flying over there, why wasn't this message universal to other carriers?
Well, in fact, Ian, the U.S. FAA prohibition pertained to a completely different sector of airspace. It was not this sector at all. It was an area much to the south of where Malaysia 17 was shot down, and the concerns there were over communications issues, not over missiles or any dangers of that sort. The area where MH17 was and many other aircraft were, as I understand, Lufthansa, other major carriers were using these same corridors, was open, was, for lack of a better term, a legal airspace, and had been deemed safe by the entities whose job it is to determine which parts of the sky are safe and unsafe. And that's not a commercial air carrier's job. It's the job of ICAO, it's the job of local governments, and the agencies that oversee their airspace. I think that's where the ball was dropped. And in retrospect, perhaps these corridors should have been closed. But whose responsibility that was, it really wasn't the air carrier's responsibility.
But it certainly does seem that just being 1,000 feet above a ceiling set because there had been use of ground-aware missiles and two or three planes in a helicopter had already been shot down, it just seems, you know, in retrospect, reckless. 1,000 feet doesn't do much, does it?
Well, it does. In aviation context, I mean, 1,000 feet is a sizable buffer, and presumably the flight level that was put there as the ceiling already contained a safety buffer from there to the ground. If the restriction is up to 32,000 feet and you're flying at 34,000 feet or whatever exactly the numbers were, then that's a safe altitude.
Well, I spoke yesterday to a defense analyst in Moscow who's very well connected and highly regarded. And he pointed out for the first time the military scenario on the ground that certainly makes sense in terms of putting this thing into context. He pointed out that this battle between these separatists and the Ukrainian government has not been going well for the separatists, even though the Ukrainian government's had some setbacks earlier. They have managed to pretty much isolate them, and that the Ukrainians had pockets of Ukrainian soldiers right on the Russian border to stop the supply of equipment crossing. But these pockets of Ukrainian soldiers had to be supplied because they were surrounded by airdrops. And that's what these Antonov transport planes were doing. And then the Russians, through their proxies, decided to up the ante and to close off that advantage by supplying the rebels with the Buk SA-11 system, and thus the tragedy. So that seems to me to be at least make some sense militarily. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's hard for me to speak to what the situation was on the ground between the competing factions there. I'm really not familiar with that aspect of what was going on. I mean, I can tell you that those airspace corridors were open, and they had been deemed safe, and that Malaysia Airlines was one of several airlines operating there. And at a certain point, like I was saying a moment ago, you have to trust those whose job it is to make those determinations. And again, that's, I think, where the mistake was made, that we need to take a closer look in the future when flying over these areas, and maybe, you know, carriers and maybe, in our case, the FAA and the regulators and airlines of other countries need to be preemptive and say, no, wait a minute, you know, even though you're saying this airspace is safe, maybe it's not, and we're just not going to take that chance. Maybe that has to be the protocol for the future. And meanwhile, not to look at this in too morbid a light, Ian, but it's kind of remarkable now when you go back and you look over the annals of aviation air disaster history. Three now of the worst 11 crashes, most deadly crashes in history, were missile shootdowns of commercial aircraft. You have this one. We had Korean Airlines shot down by the Soviet Union in 1983. And the Iran Air Airbus A300 shot down by the U.S. Navy accidentally in 1988. This has happened before, and there were many other cases as well, not with nearly the fatality counts as those incidents, but it's happened several times, and that's not to say that it's to be expected or accepted. But it does happen from time to time, sadly.
And indeed, it was the Ukrainians who shot down a Russian airliner a few years back over the Black Sea with the same missile, I think. And that was in a training exercise that clearly went wrong.
And there have been other similar cases as well. There was, an Italian commercial plane that was shot down. There was an incident over, I forget if it was over Jordan or Israel a number of years ago, and so on.
Again, I'm speaking with Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, Malaysia Airline Crash May Become Seventh Deadliest Disaster in Aviation History. And just in terms of flying over war zones, of course, there's an active war going on in the middle of Iraq at the moment, and it extends into Syria. And my understanding is that there's a very active air corridor over Iraq, is there not?
Yeah, many commercial aircraft fly over Iraq every day. Many of them land there, in fact, even right now. I flew over Baghdad myself as a passenger. It happened only a few weeks ago, and I remember looking down at the midnight view of the city and the rivers, and it was beautiful. But of course, we all know what was going on down below. But that's normal. That's routine. Literally thousands of commercial aircraft fly over hostile, unstable areas every single day. And there are protocols. There are restrictions. We have to fly certain routings at certain altitudes, and meanwhile, other areas will be off limits entirely. And you know, while it's obviously important to be in compliance with those restrictions, it's not especially difficult. I mean, this is something that pilots and airlines deal with every single day.
Well, but it does seem, though, that with the activities of ISIS on the ground there, where they literally have taken over a third of the country in lightning speed, and that the Iraqi military just left behind tons and tons of expensive U.S.-supplied equipment, one wonders whether in all of that stuff that was taken over, maybe there's a few of what they call man pads, these ground-to-air shoulder-launched missiles that can take down an airliner. Is there any coordination between the aviation community and the intelligence community?
Well, there is. And first, though, to be clear, the missile that shot down the Malaysia Airlines plane was not a shoulder-launched missile. It was a very large and sophisticated piece of military hardware that is shot from a truck sort of apparatus. It's not something that's really portable in the sense of the same way as these man pads, as they're called, which are basically shoulder-fired rockets. And, you know, unfortunately, there are thousands of these weapons scattered all around the world in the hands of exactly who we don't necessarily know. And that's been a worry for years and years now, the possibility one of these portable rockets getting into the wrong hands and targeting a civilian airliner. In fact, it's happened already, not with fatal consequences. Yeah, there was an Israeli charter plane taking off out of Kenya a number of years ago and was fired on by, I think, two shoulder rockets, and as it happened, they both missed.
So in terms of what changes have taken place today, Patrick Smith, for the longest time, of course, there's been a great deal of anguish from the governments of Malaysia and the Netherlands, whose leaders were on the phone to Putin begging him to do something about the disrespectful way in which bodies were left to rot in the fields, wallets, watches, cell phones, etc. were taken, duty-free liquor was taken as well. Kids and local kids were wandering all over the crash site. Nobody quite knows how much of the crash site is left. Do you think that there will be enough forensics there to determine what shot this plane down definitively, and perhaps by extension, who did it?
Well, I mean, we're never going to have enough to go on to prove definitively what happened unless access is granted to the crash site in pretty much close detail. I mean, we're going to need the black boxes and as well as pieces of the wreckage to examine forensically to determine exactly what type of weapon brought the plane down, where it struck, and so on and so forth. That's not going to happen without cooperation from the parties involved. And it's been really despicable and unprecedented what's been happening there. A disaster of this scale to be handled this way with you know, armed thugs, you know, keeping the investigators away and all the what you pointed out, luggage and belongings and pieces of the aircraft being looted and bodies disrespected. It's nothing I've ever seen before.
Well, apparently the Prime Minister of Malaysia has said that the Russian-backed rebels have agreed to turn over the plane's black boxes to a Malaysian team that are already in Ukraine. And, of course, the United Nations on Monday, the Security Council approved a resolution. This is an Australian-sponsored resolution for an international investigation of this crash. The Russians weren't going to vote for it until they changed the wording from a shoot down to a downing of the aircraft. But nevertheless, I guess Russia was in a position where it would be pretty flagrant if they had vetoed this resolution. And also the bodies apparently in these refrigerated carriages are going to be taken to Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second largest city, and then flown on to the Netherlands. So at least that sort of logjam of indifference with these roaming drunken thugs wandering around and the press trying to get in there and a delegation from the OECD trying to get in there, that seems to at least have been improved.
Well, it's good that some progress is being made. And meanwhile, the flight data recorders and the voice recorders, I mean, you know, with those in our possession, we can basically tell if the airplane was shot down and was it shot down and, you know, what the kind of parameters were on board at that time and how the airplane fell and crashed. But what the black black boxes won't ever tell us is how the plane was shot down, who shot it down, why it was shot down, and that pushes the investigation into a completely different realm and brings in all of the political aspects at that point.
Well, can those black boxes, though, be tampered with?
To the point where information could be erased or garbled, possibly, in the hands of certain expertise. They can be destroyed outright or, quote-unquote, lost, but it would be difficult for that to happen with all of the attention focused on this right now.
Well, though, at least the Ukrainian authorities are saying that key parts of the airplane have disappeared, presumably that would indicate a rocket impact.
Well, that's what I was referring to earlier about how we're going to need more than just the black boxes to determine exactly what happened. The black boxes aren't going to tell you what kind of rocket hit the airplane or who fired it or where exactly it was fired from. Only the wreckage can tell you that.
Well, presumably this Australian-sponsored UN Security Council resolution passed on Monday will give enough cover to international inspectors, surely. I think even these rebels are going to have to respect.
Yeah, I mean, and who knows? I mean, maybe everybody will come clean by the end of this. And, you know, where does that bring us, though? I don't know. And, you know, meanwhile, it's eerie how much this does and doesn't remind us of the Korean Airlines KL 007 flight shot down in 1983 by the Soviet Union, and how the government there then was so reluctant to admit that they had shot the plane down at all. And it wasn't until many, many years later that the truth really finally came out.
Well, but the evidence of the fact that it was shot down actually came from the National Security Agency, for the intercepts with the pilots, the fighter pilot, you know, saying, you know, halki palki, which is a somewhat infantile Russian expression, which I can't repeat on the air. But in this case, my suspicion is that there probably is quite a lot of data out there from the intelligence community. Would you expect that to be the case?
Not necessarily. Remember, in 1983, you know, this was the Soviet Union, and you had the United States along those same corridors monitoring communications and all of their aircraft movements and so on. So I'm not sure that is, in that respect, that's a good comparison. It's hard to say.
Well, there's also a lot of intelligence activity going on that very night. There was an SS-18 missile test. There was a U.S. RC-135 Boeing airliner in the neighborhood. So, but
and it's also true that the Korean air crew was way, way off course and had strayed into the territory of the Soviet Union.
Right.
What happened in Ukraine was a lot more, I think, in cold blood.
Right. But my understanding is that air crew did wrestle with the controls for some time after the plane was hit by a missile before they lost control of it. Is that your understanding?
If I remember correctly, yes. And you know, the dynamics of these situations are different, exactly where the rocket hits and what damage it causes, and then if and when the airplane breaks up as it descends. Yeah, it's possible that many or most of the occupants of the airplane, you know, were alive for a lot of the plummeting. It's hard to say because we don't know exactly what happened yet, but that's not beyond the realm.
Well, that's a grim possibility to discuss, and we certainly don't want to go there. And I thank you very much for joining us, Patrick Smith.
Anytime, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author, whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, Malaysia Airlines Crash May Become Seventh Deadliest Disaster in Aviation History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.